Hey, what's up? It's Ben Greenfield. I've got my friend Chris Kresser on the show today. Chris is, he's just pissed at Western Medicine. Just absolutely pissed at Western Medicine. No, I'm just kidding. He's a good guy. He wrote a book, though, about what's broken in Western Medicine and how to fix it. It's called Unconventional Medicine. I was able to harness him for this podcast. I don't know why I just made him sound like a horse or something else one would harness. He's not a barnyard animal. He's actually a pretty smart dude. I need to quit digging myself into a hole now and tell you a couple of things. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use a special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office. My cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. carolbike.com. In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show.
If you understand the basic concept of evolutionary biology, it's that all organisms are adapted to survive and thrive in a particular environment. And if you change that environment faster than the organism can adapt, there's going to be a problem. Functional medicine is the new model that is specifically designed to prevent and reverse chronic disease. And it does that by addressing the root cause of these diseases instead of just suppressing symptoms. So to use an example,
he's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield, and I have on the call today the author of a relatively new book. It's called Unconventional Medicine. Unconventional Medicine, Join the Revolution to Reinvent Healthcare, Reverse Chronic Disease, and Create a Practice That You Love. His name, and you may have heard of him before because he kind of gets around in the functional medicine circles. His name is Chris Kresser, and he was actually named one of the 100 most influential people in health and fitness. His blog is amazing. He has a podcast as well. He puts out some of what I consider to be the best, most informed information, especially when it comes to functional medicine. In this particular book, he's done a really good job wrapping all that information up into almost like this treatise on how you can combine functional medicine and an ancestral diet and lifestyle and what he calls a collaborative practice model to create this system for patients and for practitioners and to break all the crap that's wrong in modern medicine. So Chris, welcome to the show, man.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, and I was actually thinking about you the other day. I found like some kind of nasty, like it looks like ringworm, maybe athlete's foot on the bottom of my foot. So I've been smearing oil of oregano on it. Mm-hmm. But I know you have kind of like this history with parasites or some kind of like a worm infection that got you started with all this in the first place. Is that true?
Yeah, I spent some time in my mid-20s. I spent about a year traveling around the world, and I was in Indonesia surfing, which was the main purpose of that travel. And I got what I later learned, much later learned, was two parasite infections, one amoeba and two parasites, and all at once. So
was that just from the water?
It was, so there were, this was in a tiny little village on the island of Sumbawa. And, you know, locals there didn't have a lot of understanding about, you know, sanitation. And there was a pool of stagnant water where cows were kind of milling around and defecating right near the river mouth that went out to the surf, you know, to where the surf spot was. And unbeknownst to the few of us that were staying there in the village and surfing, the locals had dug a trench that drained that stagnant water into the river mouth, and then it carried it out into the river.
Yeah, you were surfing in a giant cow toilet.
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
So I, you know, I'd been pretty careful not to, you know, drink or eat anything that I shouldn't while I was there. But even despite that caution, you know, I couldn't escape it.
Wow. So this sounds very similar to what I experienced when I used to do this race over in Thailand called the Laguna Phuket Triathlon. It was this amazing race, like decades of history, and all these famous triathletes would come race it. But the swim, after swimming in the beautiful Andaman Sea, you cross the sand and then you jump into a lagoon and you swim across this lagoon. And I would always get sick a few days after the race. And once I came back with all these crazy critters in my gut, similar to what happened to you. And I found out after about 5 years that the lagoon that we swim across, 500 meters swim across the lagoon, is kind of the main lagoon that all of the resorts dump their sewage into. So we were just basically swimming through tourist sewage. Same thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what got you into functional medicine, was cow poop?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at that time, I was not considering a career in medicine. And even, you know, for a few years after that, I still wasn't. I was just concerned with getting my health back. But it turned out that conventional medicine was not very helpful in that process.
What did you try conventionally when you say it wasn't effective?
Well, I mean, the first thing I did, I came back and I saw a doctor. I continued traveling for 6 more months after that. And, you know, because initially while I was there, I took some antibiotics that a friend there had in his medical kit, and I got better from the acute phase. But then as I traveled for the next 6 months, I just started to get worse and worse. And so I came back home a little early, earlier than I had planned. And I went to a few doctors and they said, oh, you probably had a parasite. Nobody did any testing. They just said, oh, you probably had a parasite. Take these antibiotics. Took the antibiotics, got a little bit better while I was on them. But shortly after I stopped, I got worse. You know, one very, very long story later, had seen, you know, probably 20 different doctors. By then it had lots of testing, which initially was all negative. But later revealed the parasites, and then eventually did get rid of the parasites. But the treatment is one of those cases where the treatment can be worse than the disease, you know? So like what I had to do to get rid of the parasites wrecked my gut, and which then led to other symptoms and problems that it took me, you know, probably almost a decade to fully recover from. And you know, all the doctors I saw were genuine. They wanted to help me, but they just didn't really have the tools to deal with a complex, chronic, and somewhat mysterious illness. You know, they had been trained, to use drugs, to deal with mostly acute problems or to suppress symptoms that are, you know, from chronic problems, not to really get to the root cause of what was causing my issue and do that kind of investigation that's necessary to you know, figure that out. And of course that's what functional medicine is really about.
What did you eventually do to wipe out the parasite? What did you say? A parasite, an amoeba, and there was something else, right?
two parasites and an amoeba. I mean, amoeba is a parasite too, but slightly different. So it was Giardia, Blastocystis hominis, and then E. histolytica, Entamoeba histolytica, which is the amoeba. So I took a ton of antibiotics that and anti-parasitic drugs, but then I also took a lot of herbs. You know, sometimes with organisms like that, herbs will be enough on their own, and sometimes you need antibiotics as well. And so I had to take several courses, and like I said, that just really torpedoed my gut health. You know, way back at this time, we didn't know as much as we do now about the importance of the beneficial gut bacteria. So I was much more cavalier, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a health professional at that point either. So I was more cavalier than I would be now, certainly, about taking that stuff. But, that, you know, led to pretty much a decimation of my gut flora, which, as we know now, affects virtually every system of the body. And so I developed a lot of other symptoms like fatigue and muscle pain and joint pain and, you know, pretty severe insomnia, inability to get a restorative sleep. And, it just kind of wreaked havoc on me. But there's a opportunity in every challenge, right? So, as I became more and more interested in recovering, in, you know, taking my health into my own hands and realized that I was going to have to do that if I wanted to get well, because no one was coming to save me. And the conventional medical establishment was just, again, not set up for this kind of problem. It's fantastic if you break your leg or need your gallbladder removed or something like that, but it's not really set up for this kind of issue. And so that's what led me down the path that I took.
Interesting. Yeah, there was actually a documentary I was watching this morning. I doubt you went this far. I don't know if you saw this. It's called A Grueling and Grotesque Biohacking Experiment, where this guy, Josiah Zahner, I'll have to put a link in the show notes. By the way, if you guys are listening in, show notes are going to be at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kresser today. That's just Chris's last name, Kresser, bengreenfieldfitness.com/Kresser. Anyways, this synthetic biology research scientist at NASA, and this documentary just came out. He did his own recolonization of his body with this ecosystem of microorganisms to fix this lifetime of gastrointestinal problems he'd been having. And it was apparently successful, but it's actually a very interesting documentary. It's basically like a self-imposed poop transplant, more or less.
Yeah,
but it sounds like you didn't quite go that route. But you,
well, I did have a fecal transplant.
Oh, you did?
Several. Yeah, I mean, I tried some pretty wacky stuff. I mean, I'm maybe not quite the biohacker that you are, Ben, but by necessity, I have tried some stuff like way before it was. You know, like I think I did my first fecal transplant at least. Let's see. This would have been probably 15 years ago.
Oh, wow. You're one of the OGs of poop transplants.
One of the OGs. It was not a thing at all. I actually flew to Australia, to Sydney, to the Center for Digestive Disease there, which is run by Tom Borody, who was on the Nobel Prize winning team that discovered that H. pylori bacterium was the cause of ulcers. And he was also the person who really pioneered the modern version of fecal transplants. You know, the Chinese have been doing them. In ancient Chinese medicine, they were done, but he pioneered the modern version. So I did that. I think was
poop
probably
transplants were done in ancient Chinese medicine.
They were.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah, they're discussed in ancient Chinese medical texts. They were a lot lower tech at that point. But yeah, this has been around. It's a treatment that's been around for a long time. I also was probably one of the first people that did pig whipworm therapy, which is where you swallow Trichura suisse, which is a nematode that's aimed at restoring normal immune function. So this is based on the hygiene hypothesis.
You swallow it? It's like in a capsule, or is this like
it's in a vial? It's in a vial.
Oh, wow.
So worm therapy is based on the hygiene hypothesis, or the old friends hypothesis, which recognizes that for the vast majority of human history, we co-evolved with nematodes like whipworm or hookworm, and these have a tuning and modulatory effect on our immune systems. And, modern sanitation, which has led to some spectacular benefits, you know, dramatic reduction in acute infectious disease being the main one, has had some downsides in that it's removed, it's lessened our exposure to these organisms that we've harbored for most of our evolutionary history. And a lot of scientists and researchers think that it's at least partly to blame for the dramatic increase in autoimmune diseases and other conditions. And so there are actually lots of peer-reviewed published studies that have investigated, well, what if we re-inoculate ourselves with these organisms, whipworm and hookworm and others. And they've looked at it for MS and inflammatory bowel disease and a number of other autoimmune conditions. And at one point I thought that I had developed inflammatory bowel disease as a result of these parasite infections. And so I swallowed some pig whipworms, and I even went down to Mexico and inoculated myself with Necatora americanus, which is a human hookworm. So I've been around the block. I've done a few things that are outside the box.
Do you think that in terms of this inoculation, or in terms of kind of restoring some of these old friends to our gut, that we need to go to those type of extremes like pig whipworms and fecal transplants? Or do we just need to get out more? And this is relevant to me because I was telling you before we started recording, I just did an obstacle course race yesterday, right? Like, and I was covered in dirt and mud and left tracks all through the airport as I was walking through the Sacramento airport, you know, just leaving mud behind me. I was kind of guilty that I just destroyed their floor with dirt. But I was reading in Outside Magazine about Amelia Boone, who's one of my friends and also an obstacle course racer, and they tested her gut. And when you look at her gut, even compared to a lot of these other athletes who might be, you know, like a snowboarder or a basketball player, somebody who's not out in the dirt quite as much, she had an extremely high level of these soil-based microorganisms kind of rolling around in her gut. And, you know, I'm curious, you know, for people who think that, you know, unconventional medicine is all pig whip worms and fecal transplants, if there's other methods that you've found to restore these old friends.
Yeah. Yeah. Functional medicine is absolutely not those methods that I just mentioned. Those are sort of the last resort. Functional medicine and really even, stepping back before you even get to functional medicine, I would say just implementing an ancestral diet and lifestyle is the first step when you have any kind of chronic health problem. And that means bringing our diet, behavior, and lifestyle back into alignment with what our genes and our biology are hardwired and adapted for over, you know, thousands of generations of human evolution. And, you know, I know you've talked a lot about this diet. You know, we're talking about real, whole, nutrient-dense foods rather than processed and refined foods that make up most calories that Americans eat today. But it's not just diet. It's also sleep, you know, sleeping in a cold, dark room and making sure we're getting enough of it. It's physical activity, you know, making sure we're moving and not just getting enough exercise, but we're not sitting for too long and we're getting
180 minutes, I think, is now kind of the approximate recommendation. If you look at a lot of these comparisons to tribes, you see like around 180 minutes, which is a chunk of time to be active during the day.
Absolutely. And then what you're saying too, like spending time outdoors, we evolved in an outdoor environment. We believe it or not, did not evolve in houses and offices and cars. We lived outside, slept outside, and we were in close contact as a result with soil and soil-based bacteria. We consume milligram quantities of soil-based bacteria in the form of, you know, dirt that was still on the food that we ate and also dirt in water that we drank, soil and water we drank. So, that, you know, that doesn't mean that just going out and eating dirt is necessarily the solution here, or even that you have to spend time in the dirt. But the idea is that we want to bring our lifestyle back into more alignment with what it has typically been, because if you understand the basic concept of evolutionary biology, it's that all organisms are adapted to survive and thrive in a particular environment. And if you change that environment faster than the organism can adapt, there's going to be a problem. It's like if you know, there are certain types of bacteria that can survive without exposure to light very deep in hydrothermal vents in the ocean. And if you took one of those bacterium and you dropped it into a shallow tide pool, it would die immediately because it, you know, it wouldn't have a chance to adapt to those new conditions. Now, mm-hmm. you know, the shift that happened for us wasn't immediate. It happened over, you know, several generations, but on a relative time scale, it's not nearly enough for us to adapt to this new modern environment that we're living in. So, yeah, I think getting outside, spending more time outside, being more physically active, eating more nutrient-dense food, those are all the starting places. And it's only in extreme cases like mine, you know, where you'd even need to consider those kinds of interventions. They're not, you know, I'd say less than 0.1%, even of my patients who are pretty complex, need to, you know, go down that road.
Yeah. One that I'd also throw in there would be like hefty doses of natural electromagnetic radiation. I mean, that's another big one, would be sun exposure.
Huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Infrared, visible light, you know, UV radiation, a lot of that stuff that the people just don't get. You cannot replace that with a vitamin D capsule. In my opinion, you know, people talk a lot about, you know, like you mentioned, sleep and circadian rhythm and the microbiome and getting exposed to proper amounts of germ and physical activity. But I don't know why people still seem to shun the sun, even when I go to these, you know, like ancestral medicine conferences or, you know, health events, people sit inside so much.
I know, it's crazy. And it's really, I think there, a part of it is that, for so many years, we were taught that any exposure to sunlight was harmful, right? And so you get this situation where even when people do go outside, they're wearing like a huge straw hat and sunglasses and they're slathered in sunscreen, even if they're going to step out of that door for 1 minute. But, you know, not just from evolutionary perspective, but actual, you know, modern research has shown that that's really problematic, that we do need some exposure to sunlight to optimize our health. And it's a Goldilocks thing. We don't want too much, so much that we can increase the risk of skin cancer, but we want enough. And it's not just about vitamin D, as you pointed out, Ben. It's sun exposure increases the production of nitric oxide, which is an important vasodilator. So it will reduce the risk of high blood pressure, which is the number one contributor to heart disease, which is still the number one cause of death. It has powerful effects on the immune system, and it also, of course, has powerful effects on mood. So, so many reasons that sun exposure is important.
Yeah, including opioids. You could even argue that part of the opioid epidemic could be blamed partially on lack of sunlight, because you get a huge beta endorphin release, once you get out in the sunshine. So, yeah, people don't put enough emphasis on it, in my opinion. But I want to backpedal what you were talking about when it comes to genes and how our genetic code is hardwired for this specific environment. And you say that our environment, kind of changed pretty dramatically over the past several thousand years, faster than our genes can evolve. Do you think we could make an argument that at some point the human genetic code will evolve to deal with, let's say, Wi-Fi, heavy metals, toxins, et cetera? I mean, when it comes to the human body, is it smart enough to be able to evolve to keep up with some of these things that you say are causing chronic disease?
That's a really great question. And the truthful answer is we don't know. But I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical, for example, that we could that our genes could change such that we can somehow extract the nutrients that we require from like big gulps and chicken nuggets and pizza. And I'm also skeptical that we can figure out a way to transform the toxins that we'd be exposed to through things like, mercury and cadmium and arsenic and thallium, which is the most toxic heavy metal that we know of, learn to deal with that in such a way that we're not impacted by it at all. Possibly over a very long period of time, but my concern is, will we have that opportunity? Will we get there without some really harmful effects? I mean, it is true that over the last 10,000 years, about 10% of our genome has shown evidence of recent selection, and there have been some changes in some populations and people that, for example, have made them more able to process the starches and grains and legumes. We know of studies of Japanese people who live on islands who have evolved genetic and epigenetic changes that allow them to process the certain fibers that are in seaweed, that they're indigestible for most other people, but that they are able to digest. And that has involved changes not only in their genes and epigenome, but in their microbial epigenome that then it gets passed on to their future generations. So there are certainly some changes that have occurred over the past 10,000 years, but 90% of our genes are still the same as they were when we were hunter-gatherers 30,000 years ago. So that just gives you some idea of the time frame we're talking about.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing is, a lot of times it seems like these chronic diseases seem to spark, even though they're occurring earlier, a lot of times they strike people later in life when the impetus for genetic adaptations kind of goes down a little bit as your fertility decreases. So it's far less likely that were really enabled at the time that a chronic disease from a lot of these, modern assailants would strike to be able to produce genetic adaptations because the body doesn't change its genes as much as you age.
No. Now that is very true. Now, some people might point out that in the future, and some, there's debate about how soon or far away this is, evolution will not be driven by natural selection anymore. It will be driven by human choice via things like CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing. Mm. So, but that's a whole nother conversation. And there's a whole nother set of risks that comes with that, you know, with humans being in control of our own evolution. And I have some real concerns with that as well. But we certainly live in interesting times. Let's put it that way.
Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You gotta check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. They'll give you 20% off your first order. Last night, I got my shipment in. That's right. Paleo Valley sent me their fermented meat sticks, which are amazing. They're these beef sticks. I gave a few to some of my friends already, which they love. I actually interviewed Stephen Gundry on my podcast, and he talked about how when you look at a lot of these blue zones, the ones that are the highest ranking in terms of longevity eat meat, but the meat that they eat is actually fermented. And that's exactly what they've done with Paleo Valley. They've actually taken really good grass-fed, grass-finished beef. They've fermented, which naturally introduces gut-friendly probiotics, but more importantly, breaks down a lot of the sugars that would normally cause meat to be harmful, concentrates the vitamins, makes it more digestible, and they have fantastic flavors. They got the original. They've got one that's like a summer sausage. They have a garlic sausage. They have a teriyaki. It's probably my favorite. And you can now get your hands on fermented beef sticks that basically blow that Slim Jim beef jerky out of the water. So check out paleovalley.com/Ben. That's paleovalley.com/Ben to try out these beef sticks and get 15% off your order. Not just beef sticks, fermented beef sticks. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order.
There's another tribe that you talk about. I don't know how you pronounce it. The Samani?
Simone. Simone, that's right.
Your pronunciation sounds far more French than mine. The Simone trip.
Simone. There's an accent on the E, and it took me a while to figure that one out.
Yeah, but. And you talk about, you know, how they have this lifestyle that's very ancestral, you know, sun exposure and dirt exposure and physical activity all day long. And, you know, one of the issues, of course, when it comes to prevention of chronic disease is that's all good and well for them, but we're inside, right? Like I'm inside talking to you right now on my computer, and yesterday was great. I was out in the sunshine and I was rolling through the mud and I was lifting heavy stuff and I was walking, you know, back and forth through the grass and the mud in the parking lot to this race I was at. But, you know, now today I'll be spending probably 8 hours inside. So what type of things do you do with your patients to get them to hack their environment to be able to emulate a little bit more of this hunter-gatherer, gardener-esque existence like the Simone tribe has?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, of course, it depends on people's circumstances. You know, someone who works inside of an office building and doesn't have a lot of control over their schedule is going to have fewer options than someone who works from home, for example, and has complete control over their time. But let's start with the person who works in an office and has little control over their schedule. Even there are things that can be done that can, especially when you add them all up, they can make a significant impact. One would be to either walk or ride bike to work, if that's possible, because that gets you some outdoor exposure right there and it gets you some physical activity. You could take walking meetings and suggest that your colleague, you go outside and walk around and talk instead of sitting in the conference room. You could go outside and eat your lunch on a park bench instead of eating it at your desk inside of your office. If you can't walk or ride your bike to work, you could still, if you take your car or public transport, you could park 2 miles away from work or a mile away from work and then walk a mile there and walk a mile back.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that one before.
It's really helpful. Or you could take public transport and get off 2 stops away or 1 stop away, you know, and get some physical activity that way. So even within those limited, you know, circumstances, there's still quite a few things that you can do during the work day. For example, I recently got, I'm a combination where I have an office where I see patients. I have a home office and I also have an office at WeWork, which is kind of a shared communal office space. At my home office, I have a treadmill desk, and you know, where I can walk on the treadmill while I'm typing and working, and I can stand and I can sit.
Well, I got to back it up just a second. I don't want to derail you, but do you find yourself able to successfully type when you're walking?
I can. Actually, I learned to do that when I wrote my first book, and I walked about, I tracked and figured out that I walked about 2,000 miles in the course of writing my book.
Holy cow. Were your arms, so not to go too deep into specifics, but were your arms like kind of extended and resting on a standing desk, or how did you manage that?
No, so it requires a keyboard tray. That's very important. So, and it has to be zero tilt. My keyboard tray is not completely flat. The back of it tilts down, and that creates a natural angle between my upper and lower arms and my hands, so that they can hang. My arms can hang, you know, loosely from my shoulders, just as they would if I was standing. And then I can rest my wrists on a keyboard rest on the keyboard tray. So it definitely requires a lot, you know, a focus in terms of how to set it up ergonomically to make it comfortable. But then at my WeWork office, I couldn't do that because the treadmill is loud and it could, it would bother other people. So I found a under desk elliptical machine. So it's a little mini elliptical thing. You put it on the floor under your desk, and so I can pedal the elliptical while I'm in a seated position working. So I'm still able to get some activity while I'm sitting at the desk.
You can just grab those on like Amazon, right?
Oh yeah, they're on Amazon. Yeah. And Dan Pardy told me that according to what he's seen in the research, that the elliptical is even better for cognitive function, you know, than walking on the treadmill. And I've found that Yeah, I haven't seen as big of a difference between them myself, but I think they're both great. So there are a lot of little things that you can do, even if you are working inside, to get more time outside, to be more physically active. And, you know, any one of those changes on their own might not be that big of a deal, but when you put them all together, it makes a really, really big impact.
Interesting. Yeah. A lot of these things people just don't think about because they hear that they need to hang the pull-up bar in the door of their office or put the kettlebell next to their cubicle. And to some people who are just getting started with management of chronic disease through adaptation to a more ancestral lifestyle, that seems exhausting or intimidating or even embarrassing to be swinging a kettlebell when you're at your office. But getting off at the bus stop that's one bus stop away from your office, or parking a mile away and walking, that makes sense. And it also kind of forces you into this corner where you finish work and you just have to freaking walk to your car or stick out your thumb.
And no getting an Uber for one block to four blocks to your car. That's cheating. But the under desk elliptical is great too, because you can be pedaling that thing and nobody would really even know.
Right.
I mean, your lower body's moving.
The mild BO you might have at lunch,
right?
From the sweat.
Right.
I want to dive into a few more practical things when it comes to changing the face of healthcare. I know your time is limited today, so I want to be sure that we get a chance to tackle some of this stuff. So first of all, something fascinating I noted was I saw you mention that the Cleveland Clinic opened this Center for Functional Medicine to use some of the techniques that you talk about in the book, and they already have a 6-month wait list. In your opinion, why is that? What is it that they're doing that would make that approach so popular?
Yeah, well, most chronic disease is now the biggest health challenge we face by far. 7 of 10 deaths are due to chronic disease. 1 in 2 Americans has one. 1 in 4 has more than one. And this is the problem of our age. You know, that wasn't the case 100 years ago. 100 years ago, the biggest problem was acute infectious disease. People were still dying of typhoid, tuberculosis, pneumonia. They were dying of appendicitis and other, you know, acute challenges. But today we're in a really different place. And the problem is that our medical model evolved during that time when acute challenges were the biggest issue, and it was set up to deal with those acute problems, but it's not set up to deal with the chronic challenges that we're facing, you know, that most people are struggling with, things like type 2 diabetes and obesity and irritable bowel syndrome and, you know, autoimmune disease. These are the problems of today, but our medical model is still built to address the problems of yesterday, or rather of the last century. So functional medicine is the new model that is specifically designed to prevent and reverse chronic disease. And it does that by addressing the root cause of these diseases instead of just suppressing symptoms. So to use an example, irritable bowel syndrome is now the second leading cause of people missing work. It's really epidemic, behind the common cold. And yet the treatments in conventional medicine are all based on suppressing symptoms. So, you know, if the patient has diarrhea, they'll get Imodium or something like that to stop the diarrhea. They might get an analgesic for the pain or an antispasmodic for the gas or the bloating. None of these treatments, although they can help, relieve the symptoms, which is welcome, none of them actually do anything to address the cause of problems. And so these patients end up having to take these drugs for the rest of their lives. And these drugs often have side effects that then require other drugs and so on and so forth.
That's crazy. I didn't know that irritable bowel syndrome was such a huge reason that people stay home from work. That's interesting also, because when I worked as a personal trainer and I was drinking, you know, like 5 ABB bodybuilding protein shakes per day and a couple of protein bars and had these, you know, I mean, anybody who's an exerciser knows protein farts and also knows the irritable bowel syndrome you get from a typical, you know, quote, healthy gym diet. I would have to literally schedule in my personal training sessions to be 50-minute long personal training sessions to give me 10-minute long breaks to go and use the restroom in between clients and just like get rid of all the bloating and the gas and literally just go in the bathroom and and fart because of my diet. And it wasn't until I fixed my diet and I personally adopted kind of a, you know, a Weston A. Price-ish approach, and it fixed almost all of that. But, you know, it comes full circle to what you're outlining, is that, you know, rather than me getting on some type of a drug or a pharmaceutical to control that, what I did was I changed my diet and it fixed everything, you know, and that's a very simple functional approach. But I think a lot of people don't really understand yet what it looks like when you work with a functional medicine practitioner. Like, let's say somebody wanted to come and see you. Like, let's say I had irritable bowel syndrome like that and I were to come and see you. Like, how does it work? How is it different if we were to compare and contrast it to what would happen if I were to go in and see, you know, my local MD?
Well, so I was just describing mostly what it would look like if you went to see your MD. You get these various medications to address the various symptoms, but there would be no investigation into why your bowel was irritable in the first place, because there's no investigation into why, there can be no addressing the real causes. And it's not like we don't know what those causes can be. I mean, if you look in the scientific literature, there are thousands of studies exploring the connection between a disrupted gut microbiome and IBS, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO and IBS, or parasite infections and IBS, or changes to the gut-brain axis, HPA axis, like high cortisol or low cortisol or alternating cortisol, you know, inappropriate cortisol rhythm during the day and IBS. So there's many, many known causes of IBS that we can test for and then treat if they're present. And that's exactly what we do in functional medicine. So a patient would come to me and we would do stool testing and breath testing for things like SIBO and disrupted gut microbiome and parasites. We would test their HPA axis, and look at their cortisol production. We would look for nutrient deficiencies. We would test for food intolerances. We would assess their diet, of course. And then with all that information, we would create a customized plan for them that would probably include a particular dietary approach. It would include, you know, some antimicrobials if they had SIBO, or, you know, any a kind of gut infection like H. pylori. And they would include some behavior and lifestyle changes to address their HPA axis, or, you know, so-called adrenal fatigue, I'm using air quotes, and then maybe some supplements to do that as well. And so then the patient actually has the chance to fully recover from this problem, like much in the way that you changed your diet and were able to address these symptoms. You know, a patient could change their diet, they get rid of their SIBO, they, you know, smooth out their cortisol production, and guess what? They don't have IBS anymore. Instead of taking a handful of medications for the next 30 or 40 years, they literally don't have this condition anymore. So that's the promise of functional medicine.
Now, isn't this expensive as hell, though? I mean, like that's, and I'm going to totally play devil's advocate. Like, I've heard people, you know, even just to like see you, have to pay a lot of money compared to going to see like a, you know, an allopathic physician or getting things covered by insurance. I mean, how is it scalable financially to take that approach that would allow you to spend, you know, an hour rather than 10 minutes with a patient, or to do all these tests, or to dig as deeply as you need to dig for this type of approach to work?
Yeah, there are lots of ways to answer that question. First of all, let me just acknowledge that it is too expensive right now. If a patient is paying out of pocket, it's going to be severely limited in terms of who can access it. So there's no question about that. However, we have to remember that our current medical model is heavily subsidized. So it's a question of what we would like to subsidize. So imagine a situation where you go to the doctor and you get your blood sugar tested and it's a little bit high. Right now, what will typically happen is they'll say, your blood sugar's, they might not even say anything. That's often the case. But if they do say anything at all, it might be like, your blood sugar's a little high. Make sure to eat better and exercise more. Okay, next, you know, because that's literally all there's time for in a 10-minute appointment. And they don't have any medications that they give when blood sugar is just high normal. They wait until you have diabetes to prescribe these medications. So then that patient will go back maybe 5 years later and they will have diabetes. They will get the medication prescribed and their insurance will cover that. But what if, and we know that that patient, it costs about $14,000 a year to treat for, to the healthcare system, not to the individual patient, but to the healthcare system to treat that patient with type 2 diabetes. And that patient could go on, you know, let's say they're diagnosed at age 40 and they die when they're 80. That's a cost of over $500,000 to the healthcare system to treat that single patient for type 2 diabetes. So these costs are enormous. They're just not seen by the patient. That patient's paying the $30 copay for that patient's whole life. But imagine a different scenario where that patient goes in when they're 35 and they have the high normal blood sugar, but instead of doing nothing, the doctor says, hey, well, we know that this will progress in 5 years to type 2 diabetes. That's what the statistics show us, but we're not going to let that happen. So we're going to set you up with a health coach who is going to get you on a good nutrient-dense anti-inflammatory diet because we know that just telling you to eat better is not going to work. Information's not enough, so we need to actually support you in this change. So we're going to set you up with this health coach. We're also going to set you up with a personal trainer at a gym that we have a partnership with because we know that increasing your physical activity is going to help you keep the weight off as you lose it with the diet, and it's going to you know, also reduce inflammation and make you healthier all the way around. And good news is your insurance company, in their infinite wisdom, they know that it could cost them $500,000 to treat you if they let this progress. So they're going to spend just a couple $1,000s up front on this health coach and personal trainer. And they know that they're going to save $500,000 over your lifetime if they prevent this disease from happening. So there's absolutely nothing. There's no financial or logistical reason that that could not happen, that we couldn't have a functional medicine, you know, diet, lifestyle, behavior change based medical model other than the political will to make that change. And of course, the deeply vested financial interests of the pharmaceutical companies that do not want that to happen.
Yeah, that's a big one. It's one of those deals where you have to get the insurance companies on board, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's actually starting to happen. It's a little slower out here on the West Coast, where we have more choices. But on my own podcast, in the next couple of weeks, I'm actually sitting down with the CEO of a hospital in Connecticut, and also someone who's a manager of one of the insurance companies in that state, and they are going to talk about how they're essentially moving more toward a functional medicine based model. And they, for this exact reason, they recognize that our current system is not sustainable, not only for patients, but also for providers and insurance companies. Like they don't, you know, they see the writing on the wall. Like the cost of chronic disease is going to bankrupt them. And so they're shifting the burden and the responsibility of care to the provider. And then, you know, meaning the provider is going to have to be accountable for the results that they get or don't get.
Yeah.
And as that shift happens, providers are going to start looking for more effective models of care. And that's really what's already happening there. So yes, we're not there yet. We've got a long ways to go and it's going to be patchy and not happen at the same pace in every place, but I think we're going to get there one way or the other, either the hard way where the model that we have now collapses and has to be replaced, which I hope does not happen, or we're going to get there the easier way, which will be that we take more progressive, proactive steps like this group in Connecticut is doing.
Yeah. One of the things I've been looking into recently has been this concept of sharing medical bills. I was looking at a company called MediShare, for example, which shares medical costs between members. And that's a religious one where members are, you know, it's church-based. They're praying for each other and then also sharing medical costs. What do you think models like that are scalable?
I think we're going to see a lot of different efforts to approach this, and that the solution is not going to come from one place. I don't think it's going to be only bottom up, although I think bottom up efforts, you know, grassroots efforts for change are going to be very effective and necessary. I don't think it's going to be only top down, you know, coming from a mandate from the federal government or a change, you know, that is initiated and then trickled down from the top. I think it's going to come from the public sector, the private sector, from public-private partnerships, from new models of insurance, from new models of healthcare where health coaches play a much bigger role because we recognize that diet, lifestyle, and behavior change is the most important step we can take to prevent and reverse disease. So, you know, again, like I was saying, imagine if you go to your doctor, but you end up actually doing most of the work with the health coach or, you know, a physician assistant or nurse practitioner before you even see the doctor, because what's the point of, you know, like if we know what the most effective interventions are and doctor isn't necessarily the best person to work with on those things, you could have, you know, many health coaches for every one doctor and we could get a lot further in most cases of these chronic conditions.
Interesting. I know you take a deeper dive into this in the book. And again, for those of you listening in, everything Chris and I talk about, I'll put at bengreenfieldfitness.com/cresser. But I just wanted to throw a couple of rapid fire questions your way as we get close to the end here, Chris. One is smartphone apps, ways we can interact with physicians using websites or apps or technology or even artificial intelligence. Have you looked into that at all? Are there any particular resources or apps that you use or endorse?
There are a number of those of efforts there. Nothing that's really impressed me enough to recommend. I am a believer in using technology to augment the kinds of in-person and video interactions that I still believe are necessary. And studies show are necessary to support behavior change. For example, there was a lot of enthusiasm about behavior change apps initially. What they found was that if you use the app on its own without any interaction with another human being, it's not very effective. But if you use the app in conjunction with interaction with a human being, it is effective. So I think we need to kind of go back to the drawing board and redesign some of those apps with that in mind.
Yeah, one that I was looking at was this human diagnosis project that uses AI. Scientific American did a big study on it or a big article on it last year. I haven't explored it that much, but it looks super interesting to be able to crowdsource / use AI to help to diagnose or treat a patient prior to them actually needing to go see a physician.
Absolutely. I think, you know, AI is going to play a huge role in that regard. And, you know, a more specific example would be understanding things like the microbiome and the genome and the epigenome. Like, those are so vastly complex that I actually don't think that human intelligence is going to be able to make sense of it. I think we're going to need artificial intelligence to identify meaningful patterns and then help us to, you know, come up with ways of intervening in those, you know, based on those patterns. And that's not very far away. I mean, there are already some startups that are based on that, like Viome. With the microbiome. Again, I think we're not quite there yet, but I, you know, certainly in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to be seeing big changes in that area.
Last question. If people wanted to work with somebody like you but aren't able to get to Berkeley to work with you, is there a particular medical practitioner directory that you like?
Yeah, there are two. So I train practitioners in my approach in the ADAPT framework. So at cresserinstitute.com, there is a directory of practitioners that I've trained and that have, you know, gone through the steps that are required to be listed there.
Meaning those people actually know how to give pig whipworm and fecal transplants effectively.
The basics.
Okay.
We just started in 2016, so we're relatively new. We've trained about 400 practitioners around the world, and then there's the Institute for Functional Medicine, Our IFM is a functional medicine training group that's been around for about 25 years, and they have a directory at ifm.org. So those are two places you can find someone.
But Cresser Institute is yours.
Yeah. Oh,
smart, man. You're cloning yourself. I like it. I need to do something like that. But the Greenfield Institute doesn't sound quite as good. It'd be how to lift a kettlebell with a training mask on while standing on a vibration platform. All right.
Caked in mud.
Exactly. Caked in mud. Well, Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing this stuff with us. This book is good. I don't think that it's just for doctors. I think it's a great handbook for patients too. I loved it, and I'm obviously not a doctor. So I would highly recommend, if you have any interest in medicine, chronic disease, and changing the face of healthcare, that you grab this one. It's called Unconventional Medicine. I'll put a link to it along with everything else that Chris and I talked about. I'll throw a few goodies in, like that article in Outside about Amelia Boone and that gut biohacker documentary I talked about. Plenty more, along with the Cresser Institute, over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/Cresser. Chris, thanks for coming on the show today, man.
Thank you, Ben. Really appreciate it. Take care.
All right, you too. All right, folks, I'm Ben Greenfield, along with Chris Cresser, signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have an amazing week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.